I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to welcome you. We have people all over the world tuning in. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a continuation of our ongoing explorations on fascism and how America is becoming a police state. We've examined Wall Street, the big banks' manipulation of gold in the silver markets, the toxic time bombs, the derivatives. We've looked at the privatization and globalization of public trusts and things held in common, like our parks and our lakes and our rivers, our highways, our bridges. Today, I'm asking a very primal question. How did we get to this place where the average American, in fact, many people throughout the world, have become absolutely obedient, trained to the corporate state interest? This is an intrinsic part of fascism. Today, I will be sharing not only my own commentaries, but also commentaries from Professor Henry Giroux of Truth Out, Yosef Brody of Truth Out, David Swanson from several different places here, but he's going to be giving us his input on Obama's speech at the UN, Michael Snyder from Economic Collapse Blog, on what an Oxford professor, in fact two professors, have found about robots and computers taking virtually half of all of our jobs in the United States in the very near future, the next 10 to 20 years. So we have a lot to discuss. Time permitting, I'll get to all of these. At the heart of many of our issues is that when we turn on the radio or watch television or pick up a magazine, I've been traveling through airports, I've been thousands upon thousands of miles in the air, going to cities, trying to promote the concept of personal responsibility on health issues in Denver, Atlanta, Dallas, and other cities just in the last 36 to 48 hours. And while I'm sitting in hotel rooms waiting to get to the station, I'm watching the so-called intellects in the area. And without exception, I hear the same type of rhetoric. They're offering a corporatized way of justifying the choices that we should make. And I'm asking, what has happened to the intellectuals? What has happened to both the intellects that represent truth in the public and what has happened to the anti-intellectuals? There was a time, according to Henry Giroux, when Edward Snowden and Russ Tice, Thomas Drake, and Julian Assange, those are just a few, who've recently made clear what it means to embody respect for a public intellectual debate, moral witnessing, and an intellectual culture. They've not just been whistleblowers or disgruntled ex-employers, but individuals who value ideas, think ourselves in order to act otherwise, and use the resources available to them to address important social issues with what might be called a fearsome sense of social responsibility and civic courage. Now, I know when I first heard what they were saying, I was concerned, but then when I heard the response to them by Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and Mark Levin, and these hate mongers vilifying them, many people wishing them dead, prosecuted, I'm thinking, hold on a second. These people had the courage to tell us the truth about sins and omissions by our government, illegal activity by our government upon us. Shouldn't that have been your primary sense of rage or outrage? But it turns out, and I'm sure you've witnessed this too, that their anger is not treasonous or self-serving, as some critics argue. It is the indisputable sensibility and righteous fury that fuels the meaning over what it means to take a moral and political stand and to continue the struggle to live in a substantive rather than a fake democracy. Many times on this program, I have said that we no longer have a true democracy, and haven't for quite a while. Instead, we have a corporatized democracy. And those people who are selected, groomed, nurtured, and then elected, but not through public will, but by propaganda. So let us re-examine this for a moment. These are people who work with ideas, but are out of place in a society that only values ideas that serve the interests of the market and the powerful and the rich. Their alleged wrongdoings as intellectuals and truth-tellers is they have revealed the illegalities and military abuses and sordid diplomacy and crimes committed by the United States government in the name of security. And moreover, as scholars or scientists or educators or artists or journalists, they represent what C. Wright Mills once called the organized memory of society, and they refuse to become hired technicians of the military machine. I have mentioned several times in recent past that we have vast, overreaching, and utterly indifferent or corrupt bureaucracies. And from those bureaucracies, we have a whole new class of technocrats. And these technocrats serve the purpose of the higher-yielding plutocrats. And they, in turn, yield their benefit of power as policymakers or opinion leaders to those corporate elitists. Who care not what title you put in front of your name, Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal, it is irrelevant. They are in favor of one asset only, and that is power. Power that they have acquired by who they have acquired. And their acquired power comes directly from those people willing to give it to them. So they acquire the media. They buy the media and therefore have nice stories written about them. They own television and stations, radio stations, therefore you cannot go on and attack them. But you'll get fake intellects, those who pretend to be there as populist, like Juan Williams and others of his ilk. But you will not see these people contest, let alone even question the legitimacy of the 9/11 hearings. And yet there are thousands of reputable scientists, physicists, engineers, architects who have forensically examined the evidence and found that it is without merit and therefore should be redone by truly independent scientists. And yet even this argument is not allowed on many Pacifica stations. Or if you are one who mentioned it, you're ridiculed and mocked as somehow you are less than, when it's just the opposite. You are more interested in the truth and therefore willing to repudiate the false statements that have been made. And yet the complacent, as Chris Hedges would say, complacent and cooperative left, the corporate left and the corporate liberals or the limousine liberals or the faux liberals, as well as on the conservative and Republican side, all have missed all of this. How is that possible? Well, it's not difficult. And here's why it's not difficult. There's a long tradition of such intellectuals, especially from academia and the world of the arts, but they are members of a dying breed, and their legacy is no longer celebrated as a crucial element of public memory. Whether we're talking about W.E.B. Du Bois, Jane Jacobs, Edward Said, James Baldwin, Murray Bookchin, Martin Luther King Jr., Michael Harrington, or C. Wright Mills, or Paul Sweezy, or Ellen Willis, these were bold intellectuals who wrote with vigor and passion and clarity and refused the role of mere technicians or lapdogs for established power. They embraced ideas critically and engaged them as a fundamental element of individual agency and social action. And such intellectuals addressed the totality of problems faced in the period in which they lived and made their publications accessible and spoke to multiple publics while never compromising the rigorous nature of their work. They worked hard to make knowledge and what we called dangerous memories available to the public because they believed that the moral and cultural sensibilities that shape society should be open to interrogation. They paved the way for the so-called whistleblowers of today, along with many current public intellectuals who refused the seductions of power. Intellectuals of that generation are still alive, but they're largely ignored or erased from the public discourse. Or when they are mentioned, they're mentioned in a mocking and condescending or pejorative way. Yes, we had them once, and today most are silent. Intellectuals, according to Professor Henry Giroux, of that older generation have become a rare breed who enrich public life. Unfortunately, they're dying, and there are not many intellectuals left who have followed in their footsteps. The role of such intellectuals has been chronicled brilliantly by both Russell Jacoby and Irving Howe. What has not been commented on with the same detail, theoretical rigor, and political precision is the emergence of the new anti-public intellectuals. You may not have heard this concept before. Let me explain it. Intellectuals who act in the service of power, they're not new. Think of William F. Buckley. Brilliant man. I'm quite sure if you saw his debate with Gore Vidal or some others, you would say, brilliant. Yes. But brilliant on which side of an issue? I believe he had the capacity to debate both sides of an issue, but almost always he came down as the defender of the corporate interest. But with the rise of neoliberalism and the huge concentrations of wealth and power that have accumulated, a new class of intellectuals in the service of casino capitalism has been created. And these intellectuals are now housed in various cultural apparatuses constructed by the financial elite and work to engulf the American public in a fog of ignorance and free market ideology. We can find hints of this conservative cultural apparatus with its different public power bases in the Powell Memo of 1971, with its call for conservatives to create cultural apparatuses that would cancel out dissent, contain the excesses of democracy, and finally undermine the demands of the student free speech movement, anti-war and civil rights movements of the 1960s. What has emerged since that time is a neoliberal historical conjuncture that has given rise to a new crop of anti-public intellectuals hatched in conservative think tanks and corporate-driven universities or foundations, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Pew Group, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute. Do you think these are real, true places of intellectual curiosity that does not compromise on principles of truth? They are all grossly compromised. And yet we only look at them for the talking head experts to tell us what should be the truth on every issue. Immediately, they were the ones who told us, along with even WBAI, even its morning democracy show, why it was good to go into Libya. But it was wrong. They were all wrong. But did you see a single finger pointed in the direction of everyone on the left who was wrong? Not once, and you won't, because that is a third rail. Touch that rail and you're suddenly persona non grata. No more research grants, no more invitations. Even though anyone who looked could have seen that this was a UN-sanctioned invasion, not officially, but it was a NATO. It was supported because NATO went in with France, with the United States and other countries who knew that the spoils would be massive, even though we would create economic and political chaos. And that's exactly what we did. But there were as many people on the left supporting that invasion for humanitarianism, for bringing democracy and peace. No, all we did was completely smash the window, reach in and grab the jewels. If the jewels were water or oil, whatever they were, we grabbed them. And that is to our shame. But where were our intellects that were allowed to debate this? They were nowhere to be found. Instead, we didn't pay attention to this, and we went right into Syria to do the same thing. When there was multiple evidences that the rebels were getting weapons of mass destruction, chemical warfare agents from Saudi Arabia, and using them, they had been stopped in Turkey. There were criminal arrests in Turkey for members of the opposition, for the rebels. That was never brought into any discussion because it would have tainted the discussion. So the media had to bring all the experts in. Fox News brings the same people in for every single war. It wouldn't matter if they wanted to bomb a Boy Scout camp. The same people would be brought forward to justify it. The generals, the admirals, the lieutenant colonels, the so-called security experts who would say, well, if we don't bomb that, you know, the Boy Scout camp, there's probably going to be some terrorist threat to us. And you'd have the Bill O'Reilly's championing at the bit and the Sean Hannity's beating his chest saying, yes, we must go in there. And you think, where are the intellects to challenge these people? Where are they? And we did not have that discussion. And that is to our shame. So we just have to look at what has happened through the influence of the neoliberal historical perspective. Now, when you look at an older generation of conservative intellectuals such as Edward Schills and Gertrude Heimerfarb and Norman Potthertz and William Buckley and Alan Bloom, who believed in reasoned arguments, they drew upon respected intellectual traditions. They affirmed the world of ideas and engaged in serious debates. The new anti-public intellectuals are ideologues who rant. They speak in slogans. They wage a war on reason. And the most fundamental institutions of democracy, extending from public schools and labor unions to the notion of quality health care for all and the principles of the social contract, yes, they rail against them. We hear and see them on Fox, but we also see them on the conservative stations and liberal stations. We see them on MSNBC, the Sunday talk shows, and their writings. They appear in all the so-called most respected op-ed pages. Their legions are growing, and some of the most popular include Peggy Noonan, Thomas Friedman, Tucker Carlson, Juan Williams, S.C. Cupp, and Judith Miller. Their more scurrilous hangers-on and lightweights include Karl Rove, Bill O'Reilly, and the pathetic man who has no intellect, Rush Limbaugh. Blusterers, bombastic, megalomaniacs, narcissists. The public anti-intellectuals are rarely off script, producing tirades against, among others, the less fortunate. If you're poor in America today, you're seen as a parasite. Immigrants who they believe threaten the identity of the white Christian race. Women who dare to argue for their rights. And people of color who are not American enough to deserve any voting rights. They deride science and evidence and embrace ideologies that place them squarely in the camp of the first Gilded Age, when corporations ruled the government. Jim Crow was the norm, women knew their place, and education was simply another form of propaganda. What the anti-public intellectuals never include in their screeds, or any mention of a government corrupted by the titans of finance and banks and the mega-rich, or the scope and extent of the military-industrial-academic surveillance state and its threat to the most basic principles of a democracy. But maybe I missed it. Maybe you read it. Maybe you saw it. Maybe you heard it. Tell me the individuals who came forward to challenge all of our major institutions for having been corrupted, including our entire environmental movement, totally corrupt, top to bottom. Only individuals who support the environment are doing anything meaningful. You haven't seen it because these people haven't been there. And that's unfortunate. What does arouse their anger to fever pitch are those public intellectuals who dare to question authority, to expose the crimes of corrupt politicians, how about all of them, and call into question the carcinogenic nature of a corporate state that has hijacked American democracy. This is most evident in the insults and patriotic gore heaped recently on Manning and Snowden, who are the latest in a group of young people whose only crime has been to expose the abusive powers of the national security state. And rather than being held up as exemplary public intellectuals and true patriots of democracy, they are universally disparaged as traitors, un-American, and worse, by those who say they're speaking on behalf of the American public. The role of the anti-public intellectuals in this instance is part of a much larger practice of self-deceit, self-promotion, and the shutting down of those formative cultures that give rise to intellectuals willing to take risks and fight for matters of freedom and justice and transparency and equality. For too many intellectuals, both liberal and conservative, the flight from responsibility turns into a Faustian pact with a corrupt and commodified culture whose only allegiance is to accumulating capital and consolidating control over all aspects of the lives of the American public. Liberal anti-public intellectuals, and there are a ton of them, and start at Pacific, you want to find some of these, and then go to NPR, which are all of them, and PBS stations, as if they're one giant swarm of killer bees. And they're more nuanced in their support of the status quo. They don't condemn critical intellectuals as un-American. They simply argue that there is no room for politics in university and that academics, for instance, should have the world on their own time. Such views disconnect the power from any understanding of politics, and doing so makes a false distinction between the Spivak possibility of civic engagement and democratic action in the teaching in the classroom. She argues that this is a useless distinction because I think what you have to realize is that it is with the mind that one takes democratic action. The freedom to teach, to expand the imagination as an instrument to think world, is thus deeply political. It operates at the root of where the ethical imagination and the political mingle. And C.W. Miles goes further and dismisses the attempt to take politics out of the classroom as part of the cynical contempt of specialists. He then offers a defense for what public intellectuals do by insisting that, as he says, I do not believe that intellectuals will inevitably save the world, although I see nothing at all wrong with trying to save the world, a phrase which I take here to mean the avoidance of war and the rearrangement of human affairs in accordance with the ideals of human freedom and reason. But even if we think the chance is dim, still we must ask, if there are any ways out of the crisis of our epoch by means of the intellect, it is not up to the intellectuals to state them. Intellectuals should provide a model for connecting scholarship and public life, address important social and political issues, speak to multiple audiences, help citizens come to a more critical and truthful understanding of their own views and their relations to others in the larger society. But they should do more than just simply raise important questions. They should also work to create those public spheres and formative cultures in which matters of dialogue, thoughtfulness, and critical exchange are both valued and prolificate. A man named Bauman is right in arguing that it is the most moral necessity and obligation of the intellectual to take responsibility for their responsibility for ourselves, others, and the larger world. Part of that responsibility entails becoming a moral witness. But aren't we all moral witnesses? No, we're not. Why are we not moral witnesses? Well, because until you come with me to the areas of America where no one has a camera, no one is showing you the 1 million homeless vets, no one is showing you people putting a gun in their mouth and blowing their brains out because they were in a war, burned out, watched or participated in horrors that challenged their moral compass to the degree where they had no longer a bearing, where the antidepressants they were taking were actually suicidal, and hence they opted out. There's no story there in the media. We have no story showing 18 million hungry children each day. We have no story to tell about 1.5 million children leaving their school each day but having no home to go to. They're homeless. We have no story for the people working two jobs, yet they're considered by the politicians as gainfully employed and manipulating the stock market up. We have no stories of all the corruption on Wall Street, and if we did, then we would have no Wall Street because it is all corrupt, because it is all based upon greed and the brilliance of taking advantage within the law, wherever necessary and outside of the law, because now they bought the law. Too big to fail is also too big to jail. And they have bought the political system. Our Supreme Court is a joke, a pathetic group of used car salesmen parading around in stupid gowns as if they actually have a knowledge of constitutional values. With Citizens United, they abrogated any respect that they should have. And yet, we look at them in awe and subjugate ourselves in a prostrate position to respect them. And we shouldn't. We should be in contempt and protesting their decisions when they go against the public will and the Constitution. But they are the final arbiters, and all official institutions make sure that everything that is given to us is first sanctified as official. So if GMO crops, which can cause cancer and have not a single benefit, if we are told it's official, the USDA says there's no problem, we don't challenge it. If our doctor tells us we need a statin and it's official, then when we end up with a deficiency of ubiquinone or coenzyme Q10 and we die from it, it doesn't matter. If we take 500,000 Americans each year and give them chemotherapy and radiation and they die and are toe-tagged, there won't be a single moment of irony by the oncologist, the practicing physicians, the nurses, the hospital administrators, the lobbyists for the pharmaceutical company, their board of directors, the U.S. legislature that passes unlimited amounts of money. No one will have that moment and say, after 40 years of an official war on cancer and nearly $1 trillion spent, we have it all wrong. Shouldn't we stop? And the answer is, why should we? It's been officially accepted. And there's no two truths in America. The only truth that we ever accept is official truth, and official truth is whatever is power-based. So if the media tells us there's weapons of mass destruction because they've been told officially, then who are we to challenge it? And as a result, everywhere you look, you're told gas hydrofracking, it doesn't pollute the environment. Offshore drilling, it won't cause any environmental danger. The Keystone Pipeline, it's completely safe. Aerosols sprayed into the atmosphere, chemtrails. We're not doing it. And if we were, it wouldn't be dangerous. And the exposure of radiation, not a problem. And Fukushima, not our problem. And it'll go away. And obesity and diabetes, let's not talk about it. And all of our diet, don't even mention it. And we don't. And as a result, we end up becoming victims. But of what? How did we get to be fascist? How did we get to support a police state? How did we get to be confused about our real ethics? And it's part of the reason why I believe that we have to understand the difference between true humanitarian intellects and those that are the public intellects. Just look at it this way. What might it mean for intellectuals to assume different roles, even if in limited spheres such as public and higher education? At the very least, it would suggest educating students as informed and critical citizens by providing them with a language that will extend their sense of individual and social agency, deepen and enlarge their intellectual perspectives, and broaden their ability to think critically and engage in wider audiences. Instead, we educate students to be either low-paid workers who despise the social wage or to become a potential workforce for the Walmart prison industrial complex. College campuses, once a hotbed of dissent, have become prime sites in developing weapons of death. Faculty has largely been reduced to adjuncts. Out of 1.5 million faculty, more than 1 million hold temporary jobs. Learning is being turned into a form of commerce or training. Critical thought is now viewed as an excess in a culture in which a college education is simply a credential for getting a well-paid job. At best, students are now trained or groomed to be ardent, unquestioning consumers. The children of Aldous Huxley's nightmares, who eventually define their intense investment in pleasure through forms of violence that provide increasingly the only thrill left in a society dominated by surveillance cameras, reality TV, the culture of cruelty, and the mind-numbing experience of the ever-present shopping malls. But maybe I missed it again. Maybe I missed all the reality shows that show the worst of human nature, that show abuse and show vulgarity and show intemperance and greed and violence. The same as in the movies. The most popular and profitable game ever sold in a short period of time, in less than 5 days, it earned $1 billion. Grand Theft Auto just a few weeks ago. That tells us who we have become. What we support is who we are. Now, against the onslaught of anti-public intellectuals, there is a more laudable role that the intellectuals can develop, such as working with other intellectuals and community groups in a variety of sites. Those important social and political and economic issues that are now destroying all vestiges of the public good and democracy. We can work together from issues like poverty, war, militarization, the war on women, the privatization and commodification of education, and the full-fledged corporate destruction of the environment. Though the conditions supporting such practices are diminishing in American society, such public concerns and political interventions, largely educational in nature, are particularly crucial, and they're needed more than ever for young people, educators, and engaged citizens who are struggling to make education a central feature of politics. I challenge you to stop looking at the billionaires like Bill Gates and former trader and hedge fund manager Nassim Nicholas Taleb and celebrities like the rock star Bono as public intellectuals. They have nothing in common with true intellects. Instead, there is a need for this generation of youth to be exposed to public intellectuals who are working actively to develop those formative cultures in which social, cultural, and economic conditions can be put in place that provide opportunities for young people to learn how to be engaged, socially responsible, and critical agents. In an age of intense militarization and selfishness and commodification and widespread injustices, and educators, teachers, artists, and other culture workers must find new ways to struggle against being reduced to what one is called experts of legitimization. Of course, there are remnants of such intellectuals. We have Jeffrey St. Clair and Eric Altman and Kathy Pollitt and Glenn Greenwald and others writing for alternative media. I do not include The Nation magazine. But The Guardian and Truthout and Counterpunch and Truthdig and Alternate, these are legitimate in global research. But they constitute a tiny minority. And there's a small subgroup in and out of outside the universities, people such as David Theo Goldberg and David Liu and Stanley Arnowitz and Carol Becker and Chris Hedges, Angela Davis, Cornel West and Robin D.G. Kelly and others. But again, they constitute a tiny minority. Some have argued wrongly, in my estimation, that such intellectuals, because they address a broader audience in public issues, betray the scholarly tradition. But by not being rigorous theoretically, excuse me, but since when do we dismiss people who address issues as if they have no right to? And the only right they have is they must be theoretically rigorous. Sorry, I don't buy it. What does it mean to be a public intellect at a time when intellectual culture, thoughtful analysis, and rigorous criticism are being held in such low regard by such individuals as the majority of the American public? At the very least, public intellectuals should work diligently to enable people to translate private issues into public concerns. And we did that at one time. One of the great threats to a democracy is the collapse of the public into the private and then the loss of the ability on the part of the public to connect private troubles to larger systemic issues. This politics of disconnect and its refusal to understand issues within broader historical and relational contexts is the function of a neoliberal mode of public power grabbing that is central to the success of the right-wing and left-wing counter-revolutions and has to be stopped. Clearly, there are a host of issues public intellectuals should be addressing, but what we do not have today, with rare exception, is we do not have a cohesive group of people working together. We are fractured, and we need to put the ego at the door and find ways we can bring our cumulative insights to work on a given issue. That was the reason I founded the Progressive Radio Network, and I want to thank the millions upon millions of people who come for their articles and listening to people you will not hear. They won't go. Many of them will not go on many of the other stations because they just feel that they're just, the others are just too compromised. But we don't compromise. Let's just remember the dominant reactions to Edward Snowden's revelations about the National Security Agency and PRISM program should shame us as a nation as a result of revealing crucial information that the government unlawfully kept secret. It has been vilified by the media and labeled a criminal by the Obama administration. The real crime in this case is revealing that your government is wrongfully spying in multiple ways on almost all Americans, regardless of whether they have committed any crime or not. Kristen Powers is right in arguing that the real problem is that Snowden didn't understand that his role is to sit and be quiet while the best and brightest keep Americans in the dark about government snooping on private citizens. In this scenario, the crimes of an authoritarian government appear to be off limits and beyond critique for any accountability. Well, to me, this is just an Orwellian script where peace is truly war and the acts of criminals are heroic. Though it is a matter of public record that the U.S. government has killed children through drone strikes in Afghanistan, lied about the reasons that led to the Iraq war, and then did the same thing in Syria, trying to, refused to prosecute government officials and the CIA operatives who openly admitted they either supported or committed torture in Iraq and Afghanistan, the American public could care less. They want to know what's on the menu of all I can eat, drink, and turn on the next comedy. All the while, brave whistleblowers are imprisoned. They could care less. These people are subjected to solitary confinement, labeled as traitors for exposing the crimes of their government. After 30 years of a market-driven immorality, political corruption at every level, our state legislators have sold out to ALEC, the American Exchange Legislative Exchange Council, long ago. Governors, these are all sociopathic personalities. In a culture of cruelty and irresponsibility, the American public appears, to me, lifeless as it moves through a fog of civic illiteracy and unchecked greed and power. All the while, too many Americans appear to be on life support, drowning in a tidal wave of celebrity-driven, commodified culture that makes stupidity a virtue, rewards armies of quasi-intellectuals who parade through the major news channels and talk shows while unabashedly renouncing all connections to civic courage and truth-telling, and refuse to make the titans of finance and government accountable for any crime. As state and corporate terrorism proliferate, the quasi-intellectuals raise their voices, you can hear them on NPR, and deliver their scripted slogans, only to condemn those brave enough to expose the abuses of a government and corporate elites that undermine all vestiges of a democracy. We have too many anti-public intellectuals or quasi-intellectuals who no longer believe in the intellectual vocation, truth-telling, or the practice of freedom. What is new is not the repression of dissent by the government, but the scope and extent to which various types of intellectuals have been seduced by academia and corporations, the military-industrial surveillance complex, and mass cultural industries. They have been absorbed into what C. Wright Mills called the power elite And rather than criticize government and corporate propaganda, they produce and normalize it. All one has to do is follow the career of academics like David Steiner, Nathan Glazier, John Campbell, Glenn Hubbard, or Martin Feldstein, or for that matter, the number of college presidents such as Ruth Simmons. Remember her? One-time president of Brown University, and Deborah Spar, president of Barnard College, both of whom sat on the board of directors of Goldman Sachs. There are also the examples of Susan Hockfold, the president of MIT, who sat on the board of General Electric, and Carol Christ, the president of Smith College, who graced the board of Merrill Lynch. And her with her presence, these people had power, but they were also yielding to two powers simultaneously, that of being at a major university in a position of policymaker and also serving the financial interests of those that had hired them on Wall Street. As Charles Ferguson pointed out in Predator Nation, this reads like a board of academic shame. One has to wonder how such powerful academics shaped or stifled the culture of questioning and dissent on their own campuses, especially when it had been aimed at the types of institutions from which they derived their salaries and helped to legitimate as corporate models of leadership. Walt Disney, the ultimate self-promoter and cheerleader for the free market, would be turning over in his grave with envy in the face of this type of hubris. At the same time, those few critical and public intellectuals who voice their concerns almost never appear in the dominant media or are held up as heroic intellectuals. Yes, Stanley Arnowitz, Angela Davis, and many other public intellectuals well known in the alternative media are completely absent from the dominant culture apparatuses. And while many notable public intellectuals are simply erased from the mainstream media, there are others who are removed from textbooks, deleted from the intellectual archives of the country, or renounced simply as traitors. And that continues. So in summation, at a time when American society is immersed in the psychosis of war and capital accumulation, regardless of the social cost, and intellectuals, artists, media pundits, academics, journalists, and other cultural workers should be engaged in a critical dialogue with the American public. And if they're not, I think it is fair to say that they are then no longer public intellectuals, in which case they're nothing more than, as I mentioned at the very beginning, evolving bureaucrats into specialists, into technocrats to serve the plutocrats. Or even worse, they become complicit with the warfare surveillance state, and hence they are the bridge line for fascism to maintain its chronic sense of fear of we the people, the small handful of Americans still free, still independent, and even fewer who are intellectual. Those who work in the realm of ideas and willingly retreat from the notion of intellectual work as a vocation in the pursuit of truth-telling and the practice of freedom have been reduced to a subaltern class of legitimization technicians who expand the culture of conformity and the machineries of war and violence and death, even when they are not aware of what the consequences of their withdrawal from society implies. On the other hand, public intellectuals who do engage society critically to expose the mad violence of war, mass surveillance, and hyper-nationalism are on the wane, and rather than command attention and respect, are relegated to the status of being unprofessional or un-American or even worse, traitors. A shameful example of this type of hyper-patriotic baiting was on full display when a mouthpiece for corporate America, David Gregory, the host of Meet the Press Sunday, asked Glenn Greenwald recently why he should not be charged with a crime given his dealings with Edward Snowden. Not only was Gregory impugning the critical work that journalists should be doing as part of their fifth estate, but actually suggesting that journalists who help expose governmental corruption and illegality should be subject to criminal punishment. David Gregory, you are a perfect captain of 1984. You are the ultimate Orwellian puppet, and willingly so, that I am sure. And since the 1970s, public intellectuals have been under attack, especially in the United States. Dissent is now disparaged, repressed, or subject to criminal prosecution, as in the widely publicized examples of Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning. At the same time, the neoliberal coma of normalization and anti-intellectualism has radically undermined those public spheres and formative cultures that are capable and crucial to the production of public intellectuals. Dissent and displays of collected civic courage are frowned upon. That is, higher education, the cultural industry, and other crucial public spheres have largely been commodified, subject to the imperatives of a casino capitalism that only views intellectuals as servants of the state, military-industrial complex, and corporations. In addition to the ideological and structural crisis facing intellectuals, there is the emergence of new electronic and screen technologies that, in the absence of strong public values, can dampen any vestige of critical thought and civil literacy, making it all the more difficult for individuals to think critically and take risks and act with a sense of civic courage. It has become too easy today for intellectuals to sell their wares to the big banks and financial services and other corporate demonists that control the commanding institutions of most societies in the West. And that is unfortunate. And finally, at the same time as higher education comes under the influence of neoliberal modes of governance, faculties are reduced to a largely contingent and part-time subaltern class of underpaid workers modeled after the labor practices of Walmart. Too many young faculty and students are deep in debt, and their positions are too precarious for them to speak out critically in and out of the classroom on important social issues for fear of losing their jobs. Similarly, in too many cases, the distorted and business-driven notion of professionalization and that increasingly drives certain areas such as social sciences, humanities, and liberal arts sanction and reward modes of scholarship steeped in forms of jargon and specialized languages that a very limited number of people can understand and serves largely to render them irrelevant in addressing any public important issues. The instrumental logic of the data collectors too often finds its counterpart in those intellectuals who are lost in their careers and endlessly interview themselves. They do everything they can to make themselves irrelevant, while undermining the development of a healthy sense of intellectual vocation and the need for intellectuals to address human suffering, make power accountable, and interpret, question, and interrogate authority rather than simply succumb to it. And we can thank Professor Henry Giroux of Truth Out for these insights. One other concept, and I will not have a great deal of time to go into it, but I believe it's worth mentioning. And we can thank Joseph Brody of Truth Out for these insights. Do you remember 50 years ago reading about what happened, or maybe you were alive then? Yale psychologist Stanley Milgram published a groundbreaking article describing a unique human behavior experiment, the study and its many variations. While ethically controversial, it gave us new insights into human tendencies to obey authority. Surprisingly, the experts and everyone else on just how susceptible we are to doing the bidding of others in power. Now, the original experiment revealed that a majority of participants would dutifully administer increasingly severe electric shocks to strangers, up to and including death, because an authority figure told them to do so. Pull the levers. And it was necessary and required. People obeyed all the way to the end, did so even as they experienced tremendous moral conflict. Now, despite their distress, they never once questioned the basic premise of the situation that was fed to them. The institution needed their compliance for the betterment of the common good. So I ask you this, and here's an important issue to ask. When you consider our police state and the militarization of our police, and you see police officers arresting six-year-old children, putting them in handcuffs, when you see a young schoolgirl who has sleep apnea, and she's falling asleep while reading Huckleberry Finn, and she's slammed against the wall, and she's manhandled to the ground by a policeman and handcuffed. Where is the thought by these police that they're acting in such a reprehensibly violent way? Why is it that we see a naked man on a roof and there's about 30 police and they shoot him dead? What exactly could he do to hurt them? And yet no one questioned, not even the police. Maybe there was another way of dealing with this. And the SWAT teams that routinely take over just common civil issues. And we don't consider it important when our neighbor's house, the door is battered down and police go in and shoot someone to death and then only find out wrong house, wrong person. Oh, too bad. Any remorse? None. Any sense of pause? Not for a second. And all those pilots killing all those people, innocent people, have any of those people been brought to trial? Have any of them been found guilty? Have any of them had a jury? Have they been able to give a defense? Not one. And we lie about everything. We are a nation of pathological liars at every level. From the President of the United States and everyone in Congress, everyone lies all the time. We don't kill people. Yes, we do. We don't torture people. All the time we do. We don't spy on people. You've never stopped spying. We don't really read your mail. Yes, you did. You read every single letter. You listen to every single word in every conversation. And yet you're not held accountable by chronically lying. Corporations will betray us. And the people working in the corporations will sell us drugs like Vioxx that kill 60,000 Americans to 500,000 Americans with one drug over 4 years. That means more Americans died from taking one bad drug than all of American casualties in the Vietnam War. But we don't have any monument to the 60,000 dead innocent civilians who were sacrificed for corporate profit. No one was held accountable. No judgment was made. No condemnation on the moral outrage that should have been there. In fact, there was no moral outrage. Why? Because we are obedient to the corporate state authority. And that is dangerous. It is extremely dangerous. Obedience and disobedience are universal social experiences. All human beings know what it feels like to obey with varying degrees of enthusiasm. And we all know what it feels like to disobey. Each of us has plenty of experience with both. And we are always capable of one or the other at any given moment. Every individual with the capacity for independent thinking and action makes multiple daily decisions about whether to obey or disobey various laws and rules and wishes and suggestions of others, whether or not we are aware of these decisions or not. Modern societies are largely founded on the seductive idea that valuing obedience over disobedience will bring personal success and social cohesion. We are taught from an early age that even minor disobedience will be sharply punished and gives us a scary prospect like personal failure and social chaos. These emotionally powerful messages are drilled into us at home and at school, cultivating the necessary habits for powerful interests to function effectively from parents and teachers and to institutions and even multinational corporations. And when it comes to the nature of obedience and disobedience, there's nothing we could accurately call normal. While obedience can be a particularly strong habit to break, humans are born neither obedient nor disobedient. We have strong tendencies to engage in both types of behavior across cultural and generations in rational and irrational ways. And whether to obey or disobey in any given situation is a personal choice. Human social reality is extremely variable and complex. As long as we remain social creatures, we must deal with far more destruction and savagery and death than acts of disobedience. Maybe most dramatically during World War II, humanity witnessed an eruption of systemized violence on a scale never before seen, an outcome fully dependent upon the obedient behavior of ordinary people. The war ended with two extraordinary destructive acts. A handful of men obediently followed the orders over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, resulting in the instant incineration of several hundred thousand human beings. Soon afterwards, as a result of the Nuremberg Tribunal, it became crystal clear for anyone touched by the war that personal considerations of conscience are simply unavoidable when making decisions in hierarchical contexts. The duty to obey authority could no longer justify inhumane actions, neither morally nor legally. Questioning all obedience and then acting disobediently were revealed to the world as intensely personal, deeply ethical, and a supreme consequence. In a post-Nuremberg world, the ultimate responsibilities for one's actions falls on the individual, not on powerful interests that persuade or coerce. Unfortunately, the nature of habits is that it takes concerted effort to break. So powerful are the habits to obey others that we often continue to do so even when our actions are no longer in our own interest and when our ethical and moral and spiritual principles demand otherwise. And we can thank Joseph Brody of Truth Out for these insights. And hence, I believe that the police state that derives from the fascist state, that is protected by the totalitarian state, with legions, nay, I say, armies of technocrats, bureaucrats, engaging bureaucracies that long ago stopped serving as their principal core, the public interest, are now metastasizing to every part, every institution of the body politic in our culture. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening.